Hey there, Chalupa. How's it feel to do a podcast? I was feeling bored, and then I just figured that I might ask this question. But now I'm done. That was terrible. You're terrible. The sound quality is terrible. Jeez, it is. It really, really is. Worse than ever, right? I'm not sure what to do, though. Do I just not podcast because the sound quality is so terrible?
Just when I figured you'd reached your lowest point, you're listening to the Rish Outcast.
Hello there. This is Rish Outfield. And I imagine that you're listening to this in 2020. At the rate I've been putting out episodes, it could be 2023. But I'm guessing that this is the new year, and I'm not recording this in the new year, so I'm not going to talk about goals, the year that's passed. Instead, I guess I'm going to share a story with you, and part of me wonders why I keep doing this. But I guess it's that same part that tells me that why do I bother doing anything? Why do I have a podcast? Why do I edit? Why do I write? Why do I try to create art when it's so easy to not do anything or just lay there or enjoy somebody else's art? Do you know what I mean? Maybe you have that voice all the time. I hope not, but I do have it. And yeah, now I'm seriously considering not sharing the story with you. Dang it. All right. I guess I'm going to go ahead and do the episode. I started it recording. I'm driving. I will be for at least another hour. So, sorry. This story is called Wish in One Hand. And it's unique for me. I don't know that there's anything interesting to tell you about the story. So I imagine this one will be very, very short. But oh well. And maybe I'll get it out in time for a change. If... Just bear with me for a second, folks. So, years and years ago now, I wrote a story called Grandpa's Prize. And just a couple of years ago, I ran it on this podcast. Grandpa's Prize I wrote for a final exam in a class in school. There were these... Oh, wow, that truck is on its side. Okay, just give me a second. I'm sorry. There was an accident. Traffic slowed way, way, way down. And then I stopped to gawk because I guess there's something inherently attractive about tragedy, about disaster. And maybe what it is you are reminded that life comes to an end. You are reminded that we will eventually all die. And you are reminded that you are alive, that you still have days or weeks or months ahead. Or maybe people are just sick. I don't know. But there wasn't an ambulance. It looked like, well, maybe the ambulance had already gone. They were trying to tip the truck back. We had a final exam in this writing class where, they asked you several questions, and then there was an essay portion of the exam. And the essay was, write a story that features this and this. And it was something super simple, like there had to be a quest motif and it had to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I think that was it. I wrote it. And I got a very high score on the written part of the exam. The teacher, although it probably wasn't even a teacher, it was a TA, really liked the story that I wrote. And if you haven't listened to that episode, you don't have to. It will not affect your enjoyment or disenjoyment. It's a word. It was worth 73 points on Scrabble of today's story, Wish in One Hand. But I'm just saying. So let's just run it. It's super short. And maybe there should be more super short episodes of this show. I edit these things and it always takes forever. You would think, you know, an audio file that's 30 minutes long would take 30 minutes to edit or around there, but it doesn't. It takes an hour and a half. And well, if you're a creative person or if you're a person at all, if you're a ghost, then ignore what I'm about to say. But if you're a person, you know that everything takes longer than you think that it will. It takes longer than it should. All right. Enjoy the short story.
Wish in One Hand by Rish Outfield. Billy still sat on Grandpa's lap, not quite understanding why he was so sad, not quite understanding where Grandma had gone, not quite understanding why it was, in Mom's words, up to him to take Grandpa's mind off of things. He only knew that Grandpa seemed to need him there, and it felt nice that he kept hugging him and saying he was a good boy, so Billy wasn't complaining. After a while, the old man seemed to calm down and get very thoughtful. Billy tried to imagine what a grown-up would say and managed,
"Is there anything I can get for you, Grandpa?"
"No, no," he said. "You're a good boy for asking, though."
Then his grandfather stared in silence for what seemed like forever, but was probably only a minute or two. When he was done thinking, or whatever was going on with him, Grandpa said,
"Let me tell you a story."
It was something that he said fairly often, and those words never failed to bring a smile. Grandpa knew all the stories, funny ones, scary ones, sad ones, exciting ones, and vulgar ones that used to irritate Grandma something awful, and confuse Billy just as much. The boy shifted in the old man's grip as the tale began.
"Colt, Herc, and Jeb were young men, and good friends. One Saturday afternoon they were walking through the woods of North Carolina when they came upon a strange little man, dressed in a top hat and cloak, like he was late for the theater by about 100 years.
"Greetings, gents," the man said. "Fine day we're having, isn't it?"
It was cloudy, humid, and overcast, and there were mosquitoes the size of dimes landing on their necks, but they didn't argue with the stranger.
"I'm wondering if you lads are from around here and could give me directions to Raleigh."
All three were confident to help, having been born and bred in the state. Colt was Charlotte-born, Herc was from Burlington, and Jeb had just moved from Chapel Hill. They each supplied assistance, eager to prove their knowledge of the lay of the land. The stranger was pleased.
"I sure enjoy the hospitality of fine southern folk," he said. "And as a reward, I will grant you each one wish."
Well, the men sure got a kick out of this. But the stranger just watched them with a gleam in his eye that made short work of their chuckles in half a baby's breath.
"You'll grant us wishes?" Herc asked. "Of what sort?"
"All sorts," said the man. "For example, let's say your crops are drying out and you wish for a thunderstorm."
With that word, the rumble of an oncoming storm could be heard somewhere just over the ridge.
"Or perhaps you're on hard times and could use something valuable to get you out of debt."
He held up his hand, showing off a shiny gold ring, where they swore there had been no ring before.
"Or your coat is wearing thin, and you need a new one."
The man pointed to his left.
"Like that one over there."
A brand new wool-lined coat sat hanging from a tree branch.
"Or maybe your wishes are of a more sentimental nature, and you wish for something to melt little Mary Beth Franson's heart. He pointed to his right. Like that bouquet of flowers. The flowers were just sitting there, on a fallen log, where no flowers had been before. The friends were getting mighty spooked. Jeb was sure he'd looked at the fallen log where the flowers now sat, and found it bare a moment before. Colt, the smartest of the trio, finally vocalized what was on all their minds. What manner of man are you, stranger?
That's quite a question, Mr. Colt, said the unusual gent. Could be I'm not a man at all.
The three friends met each other's eyes, as spooked as alley cats at a rocking chair sale.
Did you tell him your name?
Herc asked Colt quietly, though he already knew the answer. Jeb started wondering what his mama would be cooking for dinner, and if she might not need some help in preparing it. Finally, Colt grabbed his companions and whispered,
This ain't right. We mustn't get involved in this, us being three church-going men taught to reject temptation and all.
Oh, that's no way to live,
the stranger said, too far away to have overheard. The three friends turned to him warily, and he held up his hands in a non-threatening gesture. Empty hands.
But if you're all three too afraid, go on your way and live to regret your cowardly decision.
Well, nobody likes to be called a coward, and that ended the discussion right then and there. Colt stuck his hands in his pockets and tried to stand by his convictions, looking from his friends to the stranger as they made their wishes. Jeb was first.
So, mister, we can wish for anything?
Anything, was the answer. And everything.
Well, then I wish for joy and wealth and contentment for the rest of my life.
The stranger smiled, impressed.
A good wish, said he. One easily granted by me.
Suddenly, there was a jingling sound at Jeb's pockets. He looked down to see them plumb overflowing with jewels and coins and big old chunks of gold ore. Jeb began to laugh then, laughing like he never had before, laughing almost fit to burst. Not almost, in fact, for blood began to spray from his mouth and nose, and he fell to the ground, laughing all the while he was dying, in a pile of his own treasure. The stranger shrugged.
I'm a man of my word.
He turned to Herc, who was still staring at the twitching remains of his friend.
Now, what is your desire?
Herc broke free from his shock and thought about it. He knew he had to be cleverer than his young friend. But he wasn't given a lot of time to scheme, for the stranger tapped his foot, then cleared his throat, and Herc had to speak.
I wish, he said slowly, to never see another day of sickness, nor heartache, nor pain, nor poverty in all my long days, until I die an old, old man in my bed.
A noble wish,
the stranger said, his lips once again rising in a broad smile.
And one I'm more than happy to grant.
And suddenly, for Herc, the day became night. He looked around him in confusion, trying to understand what had happened. But all was blackness. He had gone blind.
You have my word, the stranger said. You'll never see another sad or desolate day.
He winked at Colt, who was gaping in horror at his newly sightless friend.
Perhaps he should have wished for a walking stick, too.
Now it was Colt's turn. But he was considering turning and heading back the way he came instead.
Ain't this a lovely day for making wishes?
The stranger announced. He raised his eyebrows at Colt.
Course, our friend Herc will have to take our word for it.
Poor Herc was curled up in a ball, like the smallest of babies, mewling to himself in the grass. As the stranger laughed,
Colt tried to convince himself, to say nothing. Clearly, this was a bad man. If a man was what he was.
"You're welcome to decline my fine invitation, new friend," the stranger said, suddenly sober. "By all means, go running home like you just squatted o'er a hornet's nest. But I can guarantee you there'll never come a day in any farmer's almanac that you don't think back on this little opportunity and wish you had taken a chance. There's almost as many wishes as there are blossoms on a cherry tree, and you'll have time to evaluate the lot."
Colt nodded. He mulled it over and over in his mind. There had to be a way to outsmart the stranger. So, when he finally spoke, he picked his words mighty carefully. "I wish to never taste of death, never have any more physical suffering, sickness, or affliction."
"Ah," the stranger sighed, "just like that misguided chap in the Bible who loved Jesus way more than was healthy. You're certain of that?"
Colt hesitated before he answered, then said, "Yes, that's my wish." The stranger nodded, as if to concede that he'd been bested.
"Very well," he said. "Your wish is granted."
Colt steeled himself for the kind of side effect his two friends had experienced, but felt no change. He felt nothing at all, in fact.
"Is that it?" he asked.
"It is," said the man, dusting off his hands. "Now I bid you good afternoon, as I'm off to Raleigh."
He began through the woods the way the three friends had come, and was gone, whistling as he walked. Well, Colt didn't know what to do, but he made sure poor Herc got home to his mother and helped Jeb's family bury his body. And from that day on, he never felt any more pain or discomfort. He never got a toothache or stubbed his toe or felt a splinter or even sneezed after that. So what was the catch, you ask?
The catch, Billy boy, was that he got what he wished for. Years and years and years with no hurt or illness can wear on a man. He could cut right into his finger or put his foot in a fire, and nothing did he feel. Neither did it heal, though. He grew uglier and odder looking and more sorry for himself with each change of seasons. And when Colt got old and his natural life came to an end, he still walked around and still went to sleep and still found himself alive when the night was through. Years passed, and all his friends, all his family, all his grandchildren lived and died. But he did not. He tarried on, more and more horrible to behold, but still technically alive, the feelings in his mind and heart compensating for the feelings his body couldn't experience. Just a rotting corpse, Colt was envious of his two companions, both long dead, while he kept living, as alone as ever a soul could be.
In his easy chair, Grandpa finished his story without another word. But Billy was sure there was supposed to be more, some kind of silver lining to hold on to. Billy looked at his grandfather, unable to wait any longer.
"Well, isn't there a moral to the story?"
"A moral? I don't know," Grandpa said, seeming sincerely puzzled. "Is there?" The end.
Like I said, that was very short, and like I also said, it's connected to Grandpa's prize in that it is a story that Grandpa tells Billy before, when Billy is younger than he is in Grandpa's Prize. And I don't remember exactly why I wrote it that way, except for I just had this idea of this is going to be a fairy tale that an old man tells to his grandson, and I figured, well, why not have it be the same? In the same way as I turned the old Chinese woman that put the curse on the girl, Tally, in Remember the Future, I turned her into old Widow Holcomb, because it was just like, well, you know, if she's going to get a witch's curse put on her, why not use this witch that I have already established in other stories? I guess in those days it was a story, but now it's multiple stories. In my opinion, that makes my writing richer. It makes my writing better. But if you disagree, if you feel like, well, that doesn't make you a better writer, that makes you a hack, you're entitled to that. I've discussed before that whenever a policeman shows up in one of my stories, it's always the same, one of two policemen. And again, you could say, well, that's just stupid. Or you could say, oh, I really like that about your writing. I don't know. This stuff is all personal, and it's all taste, unique taste, and it's all subjective. And everybody, if they write long enough, develops their own voice and their own style. And that is something that I have come to like to do. And I hope that you guys appreciate that about my writing. You know, I have several stories, well into the double digits, that all take place in the same town. And it's fun to mention characters from other stories. It's fun to mention locations from other stories. And this is, to a much lesser extent, that same kind of thing. Now, I said that there was something unique about this story, and there is. Several pieces that I've written and some that I've shared on this show were written for a horror website that no longer exists. And it was called Horror Web, or The Horror Web, and they would do writing contests. I've talked to you multiple times about them. Halloween Night was the first one that I ever did for that website. It's a story that I really enjoyed writing, and I'm still fond of. And this was also a story for that website. And like I said, I did multiples. If I had to guess, I'd say 7 or 8 stories I wrote for that contest. I think I ran Closet Case on here. It was for that. There was one called Lemon Pledge that I sent them. There was one called Naughty or Nice that Big had Norm Sherman narrate for me. He called it Naughty or Nice as well. I'm trying to think of the dragon one, what it was called. There was the one about the guy who sleeps with his best friend's wife, only to find out that his best friend has murdered his wife. And I'm sure there are others, but this was one of those.
As you know, every one of their contests was that they would post a photograph or a painting, and then you had to write a story that was inspired by that, or based on that, or included that in the narrative. And this is one I don't really remember vividly. I was smart enough later on to go back and save the pictures. I actually had some of the pictures that inspired some of the stories. But on this one, I no longer have the picture. As far as my memory goes, it was of a man, like impossibly old, like a 150-year-old man. It was a painting, and I don't recall the old man looking particularly malevolent. In fact, he looked sad.
I think Hume Cronyn died around the time that I wrote this story. And he was just, he looked so old. I looked it up just to see. He was actually 91, so he wasn't as insanely old. But if you just imagine if he were still alive today, anyway, that was it. That was my inspiration. That was my, gosh, there's got to be a word for what it was. I really enjoyed the, here's a picture, see where it takes you, prompts. I thought that that was really cool. And this was the story that I sent. It wasn't a particularly horrific story, except that it is, you know?
And I have said previously that I never won any of those contests. And while that is technically true, in 2004, they did a, I don't know, end of year contest where they said any of the stories that did not win this year from that contest, we're going to put in a new end of year contest. We're going to get some new judges in. They will read through all these stories and they will pick some winners. And that one for the end of year contest, Wish in One Hand, was the winner. I may not be telling it exactly right, because in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, I think you were second place. I don't think that you actually won that. So your assertion that you never won any of those contests is accurate. And yeah, it's funny. 2004 was not long ago at all, unless you look at a calendar. But I can't remember what the details were, whether I was automatically entered into that contest because I had participated in one of the contests earlier that year, or whether you had to resubmit a story for the end of year contest. And maybe that's what it was. But if that were the case, why would I resubmit Wish in One Hand? The only other thing I remember about the story was that because of their word length restrictions, which they implemented because of me, Wish in One Hand was too long. If you can believe that. It's a short story. But I had to cut it down from the version that you just heard. And I want to say 1,000 words was the cutoff. And as you know, 1,000 word story is insanely short. Read aloud, it's about 10 minutes. And it is very, very difficult for me to write a story that's 1,000 words long. We've had the conversation before of just flash fiction, drabbles, etc., etc. Those are just so short that it's really hard to convey much of anything. And so a lot of the dialogue got cut down. The stranger character, which I chose to do with, there's a hint of an accent there, but it's mostly just an American voice. He has a way of talking, sort of an eccentric way of talking. And I remember having to condense every one of his lines so that it was less verbose, so that he got to his point in a much quicker way. And then the stuff with Grandpa and Billy was so much shorter. I don't think that Billy had asked where Grandma had gone. I think it just started with Billy on Grandpa's lap, with Grandpa saying, "Let me tell you a story." And I don't know if that makes the difference between whether a story is good or not, but to me it makes a difference. And my grandmother died, I want to say in 2003, but it could have been 2004. And so that could have been an influence there. Why Billy's grandmother had just died at the beginning of the story. But, you know, that's not really what the story is about, is it? It's supposed to be a folk tale of the American South. And I don't know why I wrote it. A lot of times I will be reading a book or I will see something on the television, and I will say, oh, I'd like to try my hand at something like that. And I feel like if I had been reading Twain, or if I had been reading Devlin Daniel Webster, something like that, it could have encouraged me to write this story. And the title, Wish in One Hand, is folksy as well. There's an old saying, and I remember the very first time I heard it, I thought it was hilarious. I thought it was the funniest thing, in the way that a kid can hear something that's vulgar and they laugh because they get the joke. They feel they're mature enough to get the joke. And the saying is, wish in one hand, piss in the other. See which gets filled up first. I've heard it said in various ways. Sometimes it's not piss that they use. I've heard somebody somewhere say spit in the other. And it's fine. It still sounds the same. Because spit and wish sort of sound similar. I'm fond of those kind of folksy sayings. Speak the truth and shame the devil. Pennywise and pound foolish. A fool and his money are soon parted. Best to keep silent and have them think you a fool. Then open your mouth and remove all doubt. The devil will find work for idle hands to do. Don't shit where you eat, my friend. You know, these things that you will hear from the pulpit, you know, old sayings that have been passed down, and they're folksy, and they're amusing in that they're old-fashioned and you wonder where they came from. Or maybe I feel that way and you don't. Just be glad I didn't give this story the title of an 80s pop song, which I usually do, and will continue to do. I guess that's another part of my style, or something that amuses me. It makes me happy. In the same way that millennials like to name their kids these terrible, terrible, awful, hideous names, like Bexley and Brecklin, or the hipsters that want to go find an old name like Gertrude or Matilda or Edna or Agnes or Megan with an H. It's just something that I can never get over. Sorry. One of those people that names all their kids with the same letter of the alphabet. It gives them joy, even if it really bugs the crap out of me. Well, that's how I am with some of this stuff. So when I'm recording this, the new Terminator movie came out, Terminator Dark Fate, which is not a good title. And I was excited about it because I'm easy, like Sunday morning. The only Terminator movie I have not enjoyed was Terminator 3 Rise of the Machines, which I think a lot of people think is fine. But I liked Terminator Salvation just fine. Terminator Genesis, which people hate, I was just like, oh, hey, this was pretty good. I can't wait to see the sequel. And of course, there wasn't one. But I saw Dark Fate, and I wanted it to be good because I like the franchise quite a bit. I saw every episode of the Sarah Connor Chronicles, kids. And it wasn't a terrible movie. It wasn't an abomination or anything like that. But there were a couple of moments that did not work. And a couple of special effects that were really bad. And then I've talked to people that were so outraged by what they did at the beginning of the movie. And while that didn't outrage me, it is something I understand. And I respect somebody's opinion. You know, that offended them, that bothered them. And then the other thing is that it didn't make any money. Nobody went to it. I was supposed to be the start of a new trilogy of Terminator films. But then again, so was Terminator Salvation, and so was Terminator Genesis. A new trilogy of films that never happened. And this won't happen either. Even if there was like one market that it had not yet opened in, and then it opened there and did gangbusters business, I don't think it's going to have a sequel. And I just kept thinking about that, and it made me sad. It really did. And part of the sadness was I kept asking myself, if somebody asked me to do a Terminator movie, could I have written a better one? And the answer is, I don't know. I don't think so. I like to write quite a bit, and I do it enough that I feel like, you know, it's a skill that I have honed. I don't know that I'm as good as I'm ever going to get, but there are certain strengths that I have, and I feel like those things work really well. Like when I am editing an audiobook of mine, sometimes I will get to a part and I'll be like, oh, hey, this part really works. And that's usually tied to the performance as well. But if the words aren't there, it's really hard to make the performance good. You know, for me. For me, it is hard to make the performance good. If you're Scott Brick or you're Meryl Streep, maybe you can take mediocre material and your performance elevates it, fixes it, saves it. I don't know. But yeah, I was editing The Night Clerk the other day, and that is another one of those Dead and Breakfast anthology stories. And there's the part where Mrs. Bice, the owner of the Bed and Breakfast, is explaining to Natalie Whitmore, the new night clerk, what happens on the 2nd of July every year at the Bed and Breakfast. And during that bit, those two pages, those three pages, I felt like the story really worked. It fired on all cylinders, and I could feel it in the performance too. I started making fewer mistakes. I did fewer relines. It just flowed really well. And I feel like that's a roundabout way of saying that there are certain things that I do very well in writing. I know that there are things that I don't do so well, but knowing what I can do, what I do, and what I try not to do, I don't know how good a Terminator script I could write would be. There was a movie called Passengers a couple of years ago with Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence in it, and it did not do well. And it got very bad reviews. But I had been determined to go see it, and I went and saw it. And I kept thinking afterward, could I write a better movie than this? If somebody gave me the same premise, could I have done better? And I didn't think that I could. Now, granted, I wouldn't have written the same story because I have different priorities. I have different things that interest me. And the idea that that Chris Pratt's character, thaws Jennifer Lawrence from hypersleep because he's lonely, and the two of them fall in love, and then she finds out that he thawed her. I feel like a lot of people, that was the sticking point. That was what the movie was about. And I heard somebody say, you know, this would have worked great as a thriller where Jennifer Lawrence is the protagonist rather than Chris Pratt. And she discovers that he thawed her at the midpoint of the movie or at the climax of the movie or whatever. And yeah, if you wanted to make a Lifetime television network movie with that premise, I'm sure it would go over like gangbusters. But I wouldn't want to write that. I don't know. I wonder if people would have liked the movie a lot more with that change, with that premise. They really bend over backwards in that movie to make you understand Chris Pratt's personality, his motivation, the reason that he does it, and that he was going to kill himself, and then he decides to do this other thing because it might give him hope. And it takes a certain kind of person to judge him as harshly as a lot of people did when they saw that movie. Also, he's Chris Pratt, though, and he's got a charisma and a likability. And there is a decency, a down-home goodness in his performances. So with a different actor and with a different point of view, that might have been a very different movie. Marshall Latham was talking to me yesterday about the Dead and Breakfast concept, and he said, I wonder what would happen if you wrote a story from the point of view of a ghost. That's a cool idea. That's one that I've never considered doing. But once he mentioned it, I thought, well, yeah, how do they know about this place and what are the rules for them? Because I've spelled out a few rules for what happens every year at Noble Oaks Bed and Breakfast. But I don't know the spiritual side of it. I don't know how the ghosts get chosen, who's going to come and visit you. I don't know how far ahead of time they know this is happening, whether ghosts sort of have a half-life, a half-consciousness after death, and they only achieve true consciousness and true afterlife on the 2nd of July. These are questions that I would have to answer if I wrote a story from the ghostly point of view. And probably what I would do is I would have someone who is newly dead and they are being told by someone who has been dead for a longer time about this place and about the opportunity that they have. And I would build it up and build it up that the main character gets more and more excited about this chance to be alive again or to interact with people again, to have a body again. And I build it up and build it up and set all of the dominoes in place so that this ghost can have a happy ending, so to speak. And then something happens and the person that was going to come to the bed and breakfast doesn't end up going, or some little element is changed and a different ghost gets to visit them in their hotel room that night, and it just totally screws over the point of view ghost. Because that's the kind of story that I want to write. That is my philosophy about life and about the afterlife. I do wonder how different my writing would be if I had different circumstances. If I had a job that I loved, where I worked with people that I liked. I looked forward to going to work every day. I had somebody to go home to at night that I looked forward to. The sort of things that would change your whole world view. Everything would be different. What kind of stories would I write then? And of course, I don't have an answer for you there. I got nothing more. I'm sorry. I don't imagine there will be any more Grandpa and Billy stories. Although, Billy ends up with the Cracker Jack mirror at the end of Grandpa's prize, and it would be fun to catch up with him again, find out what he's been wishing for, what he's been doing with himself and with that mirror. I, as of now, I don't have any plans to revisit. I don't have any ideas, but I could, like I said. I really enjoy being a podcaster, despite the mediocrity of this episode. The sun is shining, and it's shining right on me, and I'm kind of toasty warm, and I'm really struggling with falling asleep on this drive. So there's another reason that it's good to have a podcast, is it is keeping me awake and keeping my mind active, even though my eyes just keep slipping shut. I appreciate you listening to my episodes, to my podcasts. I really appreciate the people that support me on Patreon or that send me donations. There's a PayPal button on my blog. You can just give me a tip if you want to. But yeah, the Patreon thing is really special. Really appreciated. Wow, I am tired. I don't get it. It's got to be the sun. The sun is just lulling me into a sense of comfort.
Time to go to sleep for the baby.
Well, on that note, let me leave you. It is time to go to sleep for one of us. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being a friend. Keep on wishing in both hands. I have been Rish Outfield. Good night.
Well, well. We've reached the end of another nigh unto interminable episode of the Rish Outcast. Now that the end has come, you may forget how painful it was, and that it was touch and go there for a while. I am here to remind you of what we've all suffered together. However, I am also here to remind you that the Outcast is produced under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. Download the file, listen to it, copy it, share it, and bring it up as a cautionary tale to frighten young ones into minding their manners. But do not change the files or attempt to sell them, for the worm will turn on you. And oh, that worm, how it hungers. Thanks to Gino Moretto for his generous work on the logo. And lastly, none of us would have made it out alive if it weren't for the music of Kevin MacLeod, whose work also appears via a Creative Commons license and can be found at incompetech.com. Until next time, I have been Fake Sean Connery, and you have been warned. I felt like I was home. My sister. My twin. The other half of myself.
I thought that was it for the chapter. It's not.
God, there was a question I was going to ask you, and I can't remember what it was now. There was a story I was going to have you tell. Oh, no, not that story. What, which one? The squeeze the breast story? Oh, that's a good one. Have you never told that on the air?
I recorded myself telling the story, and I think I still have the recording, but when I went to edit it, I discovered that the space had run out or the battery had died before I got to that point. So no, I never ran it. I never shared it with... Big Anklevich knows the story.
Rish, why the bloody hell are you talking to yourself aloud? You won't realize you're supposed to cut all this out.
Okay, remind me to tell that story in the future, okay?
All right. Tell that story in the future.
Thanks, Fake Sean.
Must be time for their siesta, I suggested.
Is that a Mexican party?
God, I'm so sorry about this. See, I'm tempted to add new sentences every single line. Like on More Like a Mexican Nap... I wanted to write, I wondered if Jan would be impressed at how much Spanish I'd picked up from my time in Southern California. I wondered what she'd picked up from her time, wherever the hell she'd been. Gosh, that doesn't seem like a bad line.